Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Paul Clark, a member of the club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today's program. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Stan Greenberg, who will discuss his experiences as one of the world's leading political strategists. Stan Greenberg has been described as the father of modern polling techniques and has used his insights into this field to advise many of the important leaders of our era, Bill Clinton, Nelson Mandela. Well, we'll let him fill in the rest. He's also the chairman and CEO of Greenberg Quinlan Rosner. In addition to dispatches from the war front, he is the author of several other books, including The Two Americas, Middle Class Dreams, and The New Majority. He's also married to Congressman Rosa DeLauro, who represents a district in Connecticut. And well, there's much more to be said, but I think I'll let our speaker do it. So please welcome Stanley Greenberg.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Paul Clark, for that invitation. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club of California, both for the invitation and for the near century of providing a forum for public affairs and culture, and in the last half century on issue after issue, taking California into the vanguard. The state and the nation are richer for it, and I'm honored to be asked to speak and to build on that tradition. I was to share today, as I understood it, with President Obama's Council of the head of the Council of Economic Affairs at a time of growing financial crisis. I feared that there would be no one here for this speech tonight, but she was no doubt in Washington bashing AIG instead of coming today, and that has allowed for this crowd to gather, and I appreciate your support, you know, even though I will do no gratuitous bashing of AIG. As you've heard, this book is about five bold leaders who won election in times of change and about their struggle to bring people with them and to govern successfully. Today, the organizers focused me, probably accidentally, with the provocative title "War and Peace," which I thought was meant to fill the room and force me to discuss not the boring inside of political campaigns and governance, but the more exciting violence that surrounds government and the struggle to achieve peace in a very difficult world. That title actually did provoke me to rethink and to rewrite this talk tonight and to actually spend more time on those issues. There are many here at the Commonwealth Club who are dealing with those issues, and what I have found actually in working through my presentation tonight was that focusing on them only increases the sense that we're dealing with serious issues, with serious leaders, and that there are many issues to resolve. Now, this is a memoir, and my editors told me I can write but one memoir in a lifetime, though it seems that President Obama, having written a memoir at such a young age, has probably changed the rules of the game, so I can go on and work for five more leaders and write another memoir. But I wrote this to be as honest and as frank about what I do. You'll see when you read the book that I didn't write this to defend the profession or defend the leaders, but to actually think through this process as I experienced, they experienced, as voters experienced it. I wrote this I wrote this in first person, which is not a surprise, but more surprising is I wrote it initially in present tense. My editors ultimately took that out, but I wrote it in present tense in order to be able to continually be in scenes, in rooms, in scenes with the actors, being able to write about them. I usually write analytically and in numbers. This book has no numbers, and I tried to write in a much more descriptive way, but also not allowing myself to know the future. So continually writing, trying to understand the decisions, the choices people made, the pressures they were under, and has that evolved toward ultimate outcomes, which outcomes being either successful elections or defeats in elections or success or defeat or lack of success in governance. I wrote this book in part because I was offended by my profession and my colleagues that appeared to be stressing manipulation and spin over accountability to people and respect for voters. This had become, in my view, too much of a game. The thrill of winning was too central to what was happening in campaigns. And I watched a process in which I believe the game was superseding higher and partisan political purpose, which I saw in the leaders but not in the campaigns that I was part of. I also wrote it because of the political leaders themselves were diminished by the media, diminished by their treatment by public intellectuals who saw their attempt to win popularity and maintain support with voters as something less than honorable. And I'm going to revisit that whole process in this talk and in this book, because I know these are leaders who bring a higher purpose to this process. Now, it is never clearer than when we also discuss the issues that I've talked about highlighting today, when we get to issues of peace and war, and we get to issues of civil violence. So let me begin with a story. Let me begin with Syria as a start. The two authors that you're probably familiar with, Martin Indyk, and Dennis Ross, who wrote books about the Middle East peace process, both concluded that Ehud Barak had received polling data from me, and because of that polling data, which said that the Israeli public would not be supportive of a peace agreement, at the Shepherdstown negotiations, a critical 8-day period of negotiations where there was a possibility of a peace agreement with Assad, that he froze and said he couldn't do it and pulled back. And as a consequence, there was not a peace agreement with Syria. Now, they go further in their elaboration. They talk about the poll, the surprise poll that Ehud Barak received from me. They talk about him getting off the plane and saying, because of my polling, there is not the popularity to support a peace agreement with Syria. At one point, Martin Indyk says that what should have happened was that the president should have summoned his former pollster, Stan Greenberg, to come back to Shepherdstown and to explain to him why it is that to his real boss, he described, I think his words were real boss, to explain to him why it is that they could not achieve a peace agreement with Syria. Now, if it is true that because of my polling, Israel did not achieve a peace agreement with Syria when it could have happened, there's probably no more bigger consequence from polling than that. And for sure, it is one of the most important reasons why I wrote this book. That is to explore that event and others with other leaders to see whether both the truth of it, but also what the learning from it. Now, I'm quite convinced that it's not true at many, 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 many levels. I do sleep at night. I did not come away from the writing of this book that with the idea that a peace could have been achieved but for my polls. Ehud Barak was very clear. His response when I said it was bullshit. But that doesn't dismiss the question. It's still possible that polling kept him from doing it. But what was clear in my polling at the time was that we had 50% support for a peace agreement. And more than that, Ehud Barak believed, based on his experience of Israeli leaders in the past, that he believed that if an Israeli leader went to the Israeli public with a large-scale, you know, agreement on something like the giving back of Golan in Syria, with the support of the President of the United States, with everything else that came with that, with normalization, that the Israeli public would support it. He never doubted he could pass a peace agreement, that a peace agreement would gain the support either in a referendum, you know, or in a poll, in a vote of a new government. But he was very clear about the fact that they would win this. I have no doubt that he was using it tactically. He had me call the president. He had me share the poll, the results he was trying to get. He knew what he wanted to get out of this process. He wanted concessions on Lebanon. He wanted normal evidence of normalization. He wanted commitments, security guarantees. My polls contained all that, things that were necessary to get Israeli support for it, which he wanted me to share with the president, and which I shared with the president. So I have no doubt that it was tactical. Now, it's possible that he miscalculated. He's not convinced that Syria was actually ready to reach an agreement, but that's not for me to make a judgment. I have no doubt he made a tactical judgment not to move at that point, though it was his plan to eventually make an overall agreement, including the Golan. Now, what I came away from this particular thing was not so much that Ehud Barak had pulled back from a Syrian agreement. I came back from a bigger question about what is the consequence of giving leaders this kind of data. Now, for an Israeli public, this leader knew what he wanted. He knew he wanted to give up the Golan for normalization. He knew his bottom line, that there could not be, that Israel had to maintain sovereignty over the Sea of Galilee. So he knew his bottom lines. He knew what he wanted to achieve. It was critical to what he was of pulling out Israeli troops out of Lebanon. So he knew where he was going. He had great clarity of purpose. The polling for him was a form of intelligence to give him an ability to be bolder rather than to to avoid risk. He was not put off by poll numbers. They were intelligence which helped him get there. But what he did believe, which I think is important for an Israeli leader, but also for a democratic leader, not just an Israeli leader, he was in the process of negotiating. This was a new government. He had lost a majority vote on this agreement before he went to the negotiations, so he didn't have a lot of support on it. He had lost 25 points of support when he went to the negotiations and was humiliated in public by the Syrian foreign minister. So he was operating in a pretty fearless environment if you're talking about trying to make a big agreement. Okay? But a leader has to make a judgment. I'm about to make an agreement, a permanent agreement of giving up a large part of territory that Israel has had for decades. I have to bring people with me in this process. Part of my obligation as a leader is for them to see this process as one that is a reasoned process that's taking them toward a conclusion. Barak, I think, drew a conclusion not to make an agreement at that point. I don't second guess him on that. But what I do coming out of it is second guess what is the impact of poll data on other leaders who are less clear about their mission. So I begin with my exercise over Syria, sleeping at night, believing that Barak did what he did for reasons I understand, but not sure in principle that other leaders wouldn't look at comparable poll numbers. Would a Tony Blair, which he did, look at poll numbers or for a possible switch over to the euro with overwhelming opposition in Britain to that? Did he pull back because of poll numbers that I provided that said this was what could not pass in a referendum? By the way, I didn't say it couldn't pass, just that it was very difficult. But how many leaders, he was determined to go, he had a divided government on that issue, but how often does a poll number keep leaders from doing serious things? So I start there. Now, what I learned about in the process of writing this memoir and about these leaders is that they are all leaders with a political purpose. It's often a more complicated political purpose that concludes a life mission as well as a political project that intersect at a point of election that make them fairly complicated as leaders. They are leaders who are attentive to public opinion, just as I was just talking about in the case of Syria, but that I come to believe that their attention to public opinion is actually a strength, not a weakness. And third, these are all leaders who began with high hopes, but all of whom found their fortunes crash during their period in government and spend most of their time in office struggling on how to come back and to bring people with them so they can carry on with their mission. But let me start with their purpose, their political purpose and their life mission. These leaders emerged at particular moments in time because they were more ambitious, more focused, determined, better understood the moment. All kinds of reasons why they emerged at these moments above other people to be the leaders in these countries. I was hired at the point of the election. I was very familiar with their political project. It's only when I wrote this book and went back and looked and learned and came to know these leaders better that I realized that they were much more complicated. What brought them to that moment was not just that political project at the moment, but often a life's mission which passed by at that point of the election but changed their course over the course of time in government. So for Ehud Barak, he was elected in an almost landslide election, in which he ran on the economy and Israel being stuck on all on all fronts. But he also was determined to govern in what he saw as Rabin's way, as he understood it, which was his code for pursuing the peace process, and viewed himself as following a Ben-Gurion path that he would take regardless of the domestic agenda that he advanced, and he pretty quickly and had to. For various reasons, move quickly on the peace process. Bill Clinton, we came together on an election, change versus more of the same. The economy stupid, the forgotten middle class as the central concept. But what I soon realized, and were evidence of it during the course of the election, that what really motivated Bill Clinton was his experience in the South. And having grown up in Arkansas at a time when one had the resistance to civil rights and Governor Faubus, and his, as he left the South and go to college at that moment in time, as somebody who at each point tried to work to overcome the racial divisions of the South, to overcome the racial divisions of the country that they inherited from the South, which he saw as his unique responsibility to do. So when we went to announce for president, he wanted to announce at Little Rock High School. We didn't want to do that because of B-roll and other things that would lead to a kind of a backward-looking, candidacy to the South. When we got to the end of the election, he wanted to be in a black church. We wanted to be in a white church. Ended up in a black church. If you look at his victory night speech of that election, even though we ran on economy stupid and change and middle class, his speech didn't mention middle class. The economy was mentioned once, and what he said at the outset of the speech that the most important issue in this election was uniting the country. And I would argue as you go through his presidency in the end, even though he didn't succeed in bringing the forgotten middle class into the Democratic Party electorally, he did make the Democratic Party a diverse party. He made the idea that America's diversity, its multiculturalism, was a strength, an ascendant idea that I think made possible both the potential presidency of Hillary Clinton and the presidency of Barack Obama, both of which I think followed his mission, his life mission, and his legacy to the next president. But it came out of the differing life mission that these leaders have. Tony Blair brought an even stronger contrast. He ran as New Labor, following a tradition of New Democrats, but at the heart of what he cared about was the idea, rooted in his Christian faith, that the individual can only succeed if they are part of a community. He viewed it as a Catholic, Church of England Catholic notion of communion, in which the individual would only prosper. He believed in individualism and ambition, but only within the context of community. Now, I had no idea at the time that was grounded in his Christian faith. Britain does not reward politicians who talk about their faith, and he didn't talk about his faith, and he surrounded himself with a secular team of people that suppressed his core mission, even though I now know from writing the book that he had a faith group that met every week, making sure that he wasn't wandering too far off as he moved into his politics. But his faith was central to him, and it was only with 9/11, with Tony Blair, did he find peace of mind in the sense of joining his political project and his faith project. where he can then talk about the world as a community acting against terrorism, and no individual state could address terrorism on its own, that only as a community can we address it, and that's why he led globally the engagement of the world in supporting the U.S. after that attack, and ultimately by himself joining with the U.S. in the war in Iraq. That was grounded, you know, in his faith. It was undermined by the fact that George Bush believed the opposite. George Bush believed, George Bush's faith, you know, believed in individualism over community and in acquisitiveness over community as rooted in faith. And so they came, and he believed with respect to Iraq, he believed in American exceptionalism, American going it alone, with real contempt for international institutions and the global community. So he came to the same war with totally different values grounded in faith. That completely undermined Blair in British politics, both because of the war and the lack of popularity of the war, but more importantly, the basis on which the war was fought. But they came to it. But Blair came to his mission, his politics, you know, out of a fairly complex set of life missions and political mission that took him on that course. The second aspect of these leaders was how solicitous they were of public opinion, which I have come to take now not as a weakness but a strength. Bill Clinton was my entry point to that question, because Bill Clinton is the one that most people will speak about as someone who's poll-driven, finger to the wind, inauthentic, no backbone and firm convictions, and I was the pollster. Now, my first instinct was to push back on the concept, because I know from experience, and I can do this exact same exercise with each one of these leaders, is to push back on the exercise. I know that he did not conduct a poll in the entire year that he was head of the Democratic Leadership Council in the year leading up to the election. All his speeches emerged he evolved his own understanding of that period of time. I know, as I bugged him to do a poll before he announced for president, we did not conduct a poll. I wrote memos and said an elementary congressional campaign would be doing more research than this is presidential campaign. But we did not conduct a poll before he announced. He then gave his three New Covenant speeches in which he laid out his vision for America, and I think you'll see that carried through all through his campaign and into his time in government. We did not poll until after the first speech was given. And we polled in New Hampshire to deal with the primary, but polling was not driving his overall worldview. And I can go through all parts of, you know, his presidency in which polling was, you know, not part of it. But what I came to appreciate more with Bill Clinton was not so much the blank spaces, you know, where he didn't poll. What became more interesting to me was how engaged he was with people, how determined he was to win them over, how much he wanted to understand them, how important it was to persuade them, to win them over, to see where he was going, perhaps to carry them with him forward. I ended up in my 15 minutes, my main meetings with him was a weekly meeting of 15 minutes, which I would share polling data. But a good part of that, I would share postcards that people wrote to me in focus groups. At the end of the postcard, end of focus groups, postcards to the president, which I would then hand to the president to read and watch him devour those postcards. But it was a form of unmediated communication, either when people were cheering for him when he was under pressure, or people wondering why he's wandering away from the main issues that took him to the presidency. But people were, I think, very forthcoming, and he was very responsive to it. Nelson Mandela was consumed with public opinion. He wanted to head up the research program. He sat through 3-hour presentations on polling. He went to focus groups. You know, he thought that the ANC and himself making a transition from being a liberation movement to being a Democratic Party required being in touch with people. And more than that, he was able to see, you know, why they were becoming more and more demoralized, why they were seeing ANC leaders as out of touch, He supported when I suggested that we move away from a theme, which was now is the time, which was the dominant theme when I began working on the campaign, to a better life for all as our overall theme, as that would take it, that would be more inclusive, and that would create a demand that government be accountable afterwards, that it not just be about blacks achieving power, that the election would be about something more than that, and he understood the meaning of it and the power of that. But it came out of an attentiveness to public opinion that enabled him to embrace the concept. And later in government, we found ourselves in a position where the government was seen to be, you know, out of touch, you know, having been in power 3 years, out of touch. People didn't see the change in their lives. You know, but again, it was him who was able to see the change by his attentiveness to public opinion. So all of these leaders, they worked to be in tune with the public. They reported back to maintain support. They engaged and mobilized them. They educated, they persuaded, and tried to move people. It shows a seriousness about their responsibility to be, you know, educative leaders. And it contrasts with George Bush and Dick Cheney, you know, who all the time say that we don't take our views from focus groups and polls. They congratulated Tony Blair as a strong leader because they said he doesn't listen to focus groups, but he does. Dick Cheney in his last interview with Martha Raddatz, when he was told that over 60%, maybe 2/3 of Americans thought the Iraq War was a mistake, and he said so. Said so and paused. He said, we don't take our, you know, positions, our guidance from polls and focus groups. Well, maybe we should respect leaders who believe they have an obligation to understand where they don't have the public with them, thinking through why that is, and then spend a process trying to bring people with them. Let me contrast that with Ehud Barak on Jerusalem, which I in the book say is the result that causes me the most question about what I do, not Syria. Syria was the thing that caused me the most question before I started the book. Jerusalem is the one that causes me the most question afterwards. When Ehud Barak ran to be president, he said his red line was he'd never divide Jerusalem. Before he went to the Camp David negotiations, 2/3 of the country said they would not support a peace agreement with the Palestinians that divided Jerusalem. And then he went through a process of trying to bring the public with him on this question. He carried a copy of Ben-Gurion's biography with him to the negotiations. Ben-Gurion is somebody who accepted a two-state solution at a time when it was a universal position among Zionist leaders that there would be only one state. But he carried that. He met with academics who had written articles about different plans for dividing Jerusalem, not endorsing any of them, but creating speculation and a rush to read these obscure articles on various ways of, you know, dividing up Jerusalem, and began a process day by day in which opinion began to shift. You know, before the negotiations, I noted that there were changes. People were more and more open to moving more and more settlers out of the West Bank. They were moving on how much of the land they would give up out of the West Bank. But on Jerusalem, I said, dead end. I had my polls. I had my focus group. My focus group said, you know, we're emotional. People would talk about when you get to Jerusalem, it's like severing the head from the body. It's something you can't do. By the time we reached the end of the negotiations at Camp David, when they failed, over about a month period, but at the end of the agreement, a majority of Israelis supported an agreement that divided Jerusalem, that accepted international and indeed provided for international sovereignty over the Temple Mount. And then, when I went and did focus groups, when it was over with former Likud voters, right-wing voters on this issue, and we did the focus groups. I listened to people, and they said, it's all these Arabs. Why would we want to have, you know, keep Jerusalem with all these Arabs here? We'll have a better, greater Jerusalem that's more Jewish. In a period of a month, they worked through different ways of understanding it and came to support a division of Jerusalem, a fundamental division of Jerusalem that they'd never even considered before. This was a non-discussable subject. What Barack did was create a discussion, watched it move, planned it move. I mean, he set up. I mean, this was a process in which at Camp David there was not supposed to be any press and communication operations. He set up a camp outside of Camp David to send survey material. I also was snuck into the IDF base in Tel Aviv, in which I talked to Barack on a secure line to Camp David to talk to each day. And I have to confess, we didn't poll on Jerusalem until he got to Camp David. It was not a subject we even discussed. We were all aghast that he was actually doing this and then watched these numbers move and watched his thinking. And by the time it was over, a majority of Israelis supported an agreement dividing Jerusalem. So I come out of that and say, so if I can't believe my poll numbers on Jerusalem, then why should I believe my poll numbers on any subject and where I say to a leader that this is beyond what is possible? I don't answer the question. I pose the question. It makes me much more humble, you know, about what numbers mean and what is possible. And Barack was not a popular leader at the time. His approval ratings had dropped to Bush's level. He had lost his government before going in. He lost a vote of confidence, except for the Arab, but for the Arab vote in the Knesset. So you can imagine going to negotiate this agreement, and the reason you're able to go is because you had the Arab members of Knesset allowed you to go, and then you get a majority when it's done, saying, "Well, we're for this." It was unimaginable that he'd go there. Now, on the other hand, I also worked for Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada in Bolivia, and I don't have time to go into it in great length, and I'm happy to respond in questions. You know, he was, you know, somebody who was a radical reformer, you know, liberal, social reformer, both as a finance minister during a extraordinary crisis of Zimbabwe scale, who was elected president on a program of privatization and social reform, not something hidden, but ran on a program of privatization and social reform, and then ran again. Which is when I began to work for him, but was caught up in a climate in which there was a parallel set of violence that was driven by anti-system parties, driven by the cocoa farmer, and you know, and other issues. But he was pushing for the export of natural gas. He was pushing for the export of natural gas because he believed that could finance education and social reforms in Bolivia. It was opposed by all the anti-system parties. It was opposed because of nationalist issues, century-old nationalist issues, going back to the loss of land to Chile. But the opposition was arguing against the export of natural gas. Now, we argued in our polls, we did everything possible to see whether you could win this argument, whether you could convince people that exporting natural gas is a good thing to do for Bolivia. We could not find any argument that worked. We created simulated exercises in which we created news broadcasts which talked about, you know, what was happening when the natural gas came in and how it funded education. People would not support the export of natural gas. We warned of potential violence if he pursued it. He said that there's no point in my holding the chair. I'm not in this chair to not do this. He says, it is your job to figure out the argument for selling it. We tried. We failed. He ultimately was forced out of the country after the violence. And so that I had sitting next to the experience of Ehud Barak, the experience of Goni, which is his nickname that everybody uses for him, the experience of Goni, who is here now with asylum, not having been able to proceed. I don't have an easy answer to this, but only to underscore that these leaders know they have to bring the public with them. They spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to do it. They are being educative in quite bold ways. Now, as I indicated, they all crashed and they all struggled to govern successfully. I've already mentioned that Mandela's struggle to bring people back after the sense that people that we were not making anywhere near as much progress as they ought to be making. All of these leaders that I've worked with go through a similar process. it was very striking for Tony Blair. And I talk about Blair again because I wanted to focus and I wanted to end with a discussion of of war and peace. Tony Blair reached a point where there was a lack of trust in him that began with a non-delivery on the domestic side, but the Iraq War, Abu Ghraib, the failed intelligence in Iraq, all of that produced a crash in his standing. So that in May of 2004, about a year before the election, he reached a point of despair, demoralized, trying to figure out what he'd do. There was speculation that he was going to think of resigning or hand off for the next election to Gordon Brown. That was the plan at the time that we did research on trying to figure out a strategy on how do we get people to understand. Understand where he is. What our research said, the elephant in the room is Iraq. The elephant in the room is George Bush. The reason the voters who've pulled back can't get there is because even though there's this evidence of progress and the desire for reform of the public services, they can't get there because they are blocked by Iraq and George Bush. We tried understanding the issues that he faced in continuing to deal with President Bush. We proposed a message in which he showed learning about the public services and that the rate of change was not great enough. We talked about him showing independence from George Bush on climate change as a surrogate for talking about Iraq. Okay, but what people really wanted to hear is that there was learning, that he understood that there were mistakes, that he understood that this didn't go the way it should have gone, that he's understood people's disaffection. They were desperate to bring him down to size. And people demand that. And much of what I do, frankly, is try to navigate, and it's where I get in the most trouble, is where I try to navigate that on behalf of people as they try to get people, leaders, to become more humble, to acknowledge their mistakes, and find a basis for going forward. In the end, he said that he could not do it. He could not say that he had learned on Iraq. He could not show independence from Bush. For a variety of reasons. I mean, I fully accept his bona fides and believing that you could not fight the war on terrorism the way he thought it had to be fought if there was any division, any separation between where Britain was and where America was. And so he could not do it. He could not move on Iraq. And therefore, but in part ways, I became more marginal in this process. I was probably fired, but ultimately fired as a result of offering a way out that wasn't a way out for him. And he found other ways, not very successful, but other ways of getting there. I described this struggle of these leaders after crashing to come back on with Blair with respect to the Iraq War. But for most of this leader, the problem is the economy. It's where most of them get in trouble. In race after race, I could show it in Bill Clinton's race in 1992, when George Bush began to talk about an economy that was growing in macro terms. There was growth in the economy. We ran on the economy, stupid. But he kept talking about how well the economy was doing, and all we did at the end in our ads was take that clip of George Bush saying the economy is doing well, and then paused and said, "How you doing?" When Blair ran and won in their election in 97, when the economy began to move, the Tories put up billboards that said Britain is booming. Billboards said Britain is booming. It was so out of touch with the way people were barely experiencing the growth of the economy. Same thing happened with Clinton in 94 when he talked about the success of the economy. It was too soon. He was able to do it in 96. 94 was politically disastrous. 96 was politically successful. Mandela, again, had to struggle to find a way. They came through the Thai crisis, the run on the currency, the flight of capital. They thought they had put off much of what they wanted to achieve because they thought that they were economically successful. But leaders don't get that economic success in a macro terms just does not translate into people's lives. And one of the biggest challenges is leaders who've done big things on the economy understanding that people are far away from this. And it offers lessons for Obama. Because he's a leader, obviously, who came in with a kind of euphoria that many of these leaders did. He has very high popularity, historically high approval ratings. But if I've learned anything in writing this book, is how difficult it is to bring change, how difficult it is for leaders to bring people, with them, and how quickly hope turns to despair. So my message to the president, before he comes here or others come here to discuss his 200-day anniversary, my message to the president is: remember these leaders. You know, these are leaders who trusted people, who raised serious issues with them, and that who were both attentive to the public and also educators, and in the process took their societies forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Greenberg. We'd like to remind our listening audience this is the program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Stan Greenberg talk about dispatches from the war room. And now we take questions from your audience, and you notice I'm speaking from a microphone, so you need to get to this microphone or the one over on the other side of the room to ask your questions. So please come on up. We have one.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm not sure if you're aware about the flyer that's being handed out outside about Gonzalez.
I read it.
I was not familiar with him before I read the flyer, and I really don't feel like it's something I'm capable of discussing. I'm just curious as to whether you think that the Israeli population moved on Jerusalem, where the Bolivian population did not, on natural gas, due to a respect that the Israeli people had for Barak that the Bolivian people did not have for Gonzalez? Is that a possibility?
Part of it. No, it's part of it. The I have an immense respect for Goni as a leader and as a reformer. And one of the problems with people's understanding of Bolivia and Goni is that it's come backwards. It's come back from current events. It's come back from the movie Our Brand Is Crisis, if people have seen that, without a knowledge of his history, of the kind of reformer he was. I don't have time for that, but it's in the that part of it's in the book. It's breathtaking, what he tried to do, and very forthrightly. I do argue that when he came back to the presidency, I mean, he did this in his term as president and as also prior as finance minister. When he came back, he didn't nearly have the strength, personal strength. He was older, didn't have the same kinds of people around him. His party was weaker and corrupted, and it was much harder for him to carry that message and carry people with him. The other part of this story, you have a parallel story of violence that's very much linked to cocoa, cocoa farmers, and it's both violent and and corrupt. Begins with the junta, and it's a kind of a parallel story of its own. It's full of violence all through that, period. But in this election that we did, Evo Morales was getting 3% of the vote in our polls and other polls. He had about 70% disapproval rating. He was so the leader of the cocoa growers was intensely unpopular in the country, as a whole. What happened is that the U.S. had its own issues and began putting the spotlight on him, warning that if he became won the election, that they would cut off aid. And the U.S. chose to make itself arrogantly the center of this process and made him, in a very fragmented election, the leader of all the anti-system forces, and drove his vote up, over 20% within a period of about 2 weeks. So the U.S. got a result that I think it wanted because it was looking for that kind of conflict. So the U.S. is a player in this. So he was elected with 23% of the vote.
Morales.
You know, in this second election. He won in a landslide in the prior one.
Right.
But in this one, so he barely beat Evo, who emerged as a legitimate figure because of the opposition of the U.S. and the Bush administration. So there's a lot of complications in the story. But part of it was that Barack had standing as the most decorated soldier in Israel's history and had standing on national security that allowed this issue to be taken up.
So he was able to bring people along with him due to their respect, mm-hmm. which another person might not.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I guess it's to me. Your name has come recently along with Carville and Bogala about having a strategy to have Rush Limbaugh become the new face of the Republican Party. Could you expand upon that? And if that is your strategy, it's brilliant. I have no question about that. And in a larger issue, does polling cause our leaders to focus on minor issues? Bill Clinton focused on things like school uniforms and Sister Soldier and whatnot, but I don't know that he really went after some of the big issues. And my question is, if we had polling when Lyndon Johnson was president, would we have the Civil Rights Voting Act? Because it probably wasn't a popular thing to do at that time.
And we did have polling then. You know, first of all, the bigger answer is, and I'll go back to the first thing about Rush, but the bigger issue, the starting point is the leader. Does the leader have a mission, have a big project? Franklin Roosevelt, wanted to bring the country to support Lend-Lease, have the U.S. back Britain in the war with Germany. Was very, very unpopular. He gave repeatedly fireside chats, and some of the first polling ever done was done by Roosevelt polling before and after the fireside chats to see whether he was successful in moving public opinion and what kinds of messages, issues were most effective in doing it. So if you have a purpose and mission, these things are vehicles. And if you take Bill Clinton, I can only speak about the Bill Clinton that I work with, and I worked with him in the first 2.5 years of the administration. But I worked with him during the period of the time the Democrats were in control. We had an economic plan whose priorities I would, is not what I supported, but I respect why he went there. In fact, it was brave, given that he had run on investment. He ended up advancing a deficit reduction budget. He also introduced a plan for universal health care, which was very tough, and he ultimately, lost on that. That was it was bold. It was a time he was doing polling. When they lost control of the Congress, I think that he lost his way for a period in terms of what was the project, what's the mission. And you did have polling that was giving him lists of policies that looked popular and, gave a package of things to offer for the elections that they faced. But you make choices. You could have in 1996... You had the Gingrich Congress, you had the assault on education and Medicare and the environment, and you had the ability to elevate that as a principal battleground, defining the role of government and what's next for America. They chose smaller issues. I agree with you. But it wasn't because polling. We did a lot of polling when he was taking bigger issues. So I don't think the polling is the variable that we're looking at. It's, does the leader have a sense of purpose? The elections... all of these leaders came to office in elections that were formative. They had very well-defined, choices. They defined the battle. And when you have that kind of an election, that affects the coalitions. It affects, what are the policies that come afterwards. But we have elections that are tactical. You lose it. You lose the momentum. People become disengaged. On Rush, we did – it wasn't a White House strategy, but we did highlight – Russia's lack of popularity. Not it's the lack of popularity, it's the fact that Republicans who were being attacked by him were under great political pressure. If we watch what happened to Spector, those who were critical of Rush found them themselves having to apologize. So his playing that kind of role in the Republican Party was revealing about the nature of the Republican base and the nature of dynamics in the Republican Party, and helps explain why it was so few Republicans were willing to step up and be part of the process for passing the Economic Renewal Plan.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Greenberg.
I
found it particularly fascinating when you were speaking earlier about the various religious tendencies of the leaders mentioned this evening, and that common thread in republicanism and democracy and governance in general. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit, maybe perhaps, of a future of rise of secularism in America specifically, and how that's going to reflect itself in polling, elections, and governance. And I don't know your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I'm not sure where it goes. There are a number of trends that are part of what happened in the last couple elections, and includes kind of upscale suburbia becoming more supportive of Democrats. It includes the growing diversity of the country and great support not just of African Americans but of Latinos and almost all minority groups for Democrats. It includes young people. Coming in large numbers, engaging, growing as a cohort, diverse, tolerant, and very supportive of Democrats and Obama, both in 2006 and 2008. The other is also the growth of is a decline of church attendance and an increasing proportion of people who are more secular to be supportive of Democrats. And that includes the majority now of households being unmarried households in the country, which is very much related to religious practice. So that the trend line has been for more secularism, overall. Now, but there's another counter trend, that Obama may bring into this, which is both a more religious expression in both parties, but in a less polarized environment.
More religious or more of a prophetic Christianity,
yes.
Like Cornel
yep.
West would
yep.
describe
yep.
it.
Right. Agreed. In that form. But and made possible by the fact that it's taking place in a less polarized environment. The politics of the last two decades was a highly polarized environment with use of cultural issues and religion as a symbol in that battle. As a tool in that battle, which made it hard to move to these issues in that way, and it's made it more possible to have that kind of expressions of faith across party lines, which may change the way religion becomes relevant to the parties.
Okay. Hello, I've spent the last 4 years in Bolivia, and just come back, and so I was a bit
from where I'm sorry.
In Bolivia,
okay.
And I was a bit shocked to find Goni in there I don't know if you've done any polling recently in Bolivia, but he's not a very popular man. And I wanted
True.
To just, and some of the people I got to know there were some of the families who died when.
Nor is Barack and nor is Tony Blair.
No.
I determined in writing this not to write this backwards.
Okay.
That is
okay.
not
well,
to take the judgment.
Okay.
That comes at the end of the day and write it back and change okay. the story that I think
well,
needs to be
told. I just wanted to share Sorry. Just one story and ask you a question.
Okay.
I talked to many of the families who lost husbands, wives, children when Goni authorized the military to go up to put down the protests. And much of the protests were in El Alto where Morales didn't have any support, really. It was spontaneous protests, as you know, against the deeply unpopular gas plans. And many of these people lost loved ones and then have spent the last few years trying to get Goni to come back to face trial. They had to get Congress, which was against them, mainly Goni's party, to approve it. They had to have forensic examinations. The vice president of Goni supported them, and the ministers testified and also said that Goni was responsible and needed to at least come back and face charges. So I noticed in your book you said you wanted Goni to asked you to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So I was wondering if two questions. One, whether you would encourage him to go back to Bolivia to face the legal proceedings that the vast majority of the population want him to face. And secondly, whether you'd be willing to use some of the profits that came from your work with him as a client to support many of the families who now don't have fathers who can work, and whether you'd be willing to support their families who, in very poor circumstances, are trying to survive and trying to pursue a legal case against a system that won't support them.
Okay. All I can urge you to do is read the book and read the both the history of Goni and this process, but also to read the parallel history, because I spent a lot of time with the parallel history of violence. Let's not lose track of the fact that this violence was taking place in a widespread basis across the country that Evo Morales was saying that his goal was to overthrow the government. This is not that we're dealing with the president of the country dealing with the leader who is saying that his purpose is to overthrow the government, that we had captives who were taken through on buses that were fired upon. We have barricades that blocked food and all petrol and gas coming into La Paz. And the military was used to help bring that in. Now, I don't want to get into. What I find with these leaders, it's very hard for me to second guess once they're in office on how they use their authority to deal with these issues. What I do know is presidents do have to deal when you have people who are saying their intention is to overthrow the government and have barricaded and blocked entry of food and energy to the capital city. That addressing that is something leaders would normally do. But now, whether the military did that right, whether what happened at that particular moment and the particular losses that you're talking about, I can't address the specifics of that question. I know the bigger context in which it is understandable that the president of the country would try to maintain order.
Yeah, but I guess if children are killed in their homes,
he was elected.
He
was elected, and sorry, it was a result that Evo did not accept. Yeah.
But when I met someone who lost their child who was shot in the house and someone whose brother was shot in the back, so I guess my question is just someone should face responsibility for that and a due process should follow. So it's what's the role of someone who has enormous amount of trust with these leaders to tell them actually there's a due process here of law that needs to be followed. So I'll leave it with that because I don't want to dominate. But
okay.
Going back to the present tense as you were writing the book,
yes.
Could you tell us a bit about El Salvador, your role there in the recent elections?
I wasn't involved in the recent elections. I was delighted to see the result, but I wasn't involved.
You weren't at all?
No.
Could you comment on the recent elections?
I mean, I know the outcome, but I don't. I can't. I have a New York Times knowledge of it. I apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Wingberg,
mm-hmm.
What do you see happening in Obama's next election? What mistakes or events could happen, do you see that might endanger re-election?
Well, what about an economic crisis and bank crisis? And,
what about mistakes you could make?
Well, what I was suggesting, if you look at the timing of this, it is, you have to assume that in a period leading up to a potential re-election that the economic cycle is favor him, and I think there's a pretty strong presumption on the part of both parties that if he's able to govern successfully, that is not caught up in gridlock and other things, that is a fairly good chance for his reelection because it combines with a whole variety of changes, which I mentioned on a prior question, taking place in the country that are creating a block that is a fairly large Democratic block or democratically aligned block. But this economy is the main problem, and every leader without fail that I write about in this book got it wrong. Leaders that I trust are their instincts. Bill Clinton, who's it's hard to second guess his instincts and touch with people. But when they do brave policies, particularly in the economic area, the tendency is to go to the country before the country is ready for it. And so the great challenge here is to develop a narrative that helps people understand what was done, what's actually happening. It may not be translating into your lives yet, but it's something that's going to bring change. We're going to make sure it's broadly shared this time, that the benefits will be broadly shared. So to me, the critical thing is that his ability to develop a framework for explaining the slow change, because even no matter what happens, it'll be slow change in people's lives, though I have great respect for his abilities and unique abilities and the bond he's built with people and to make that case.
Thank you.
It seems like polls can be constructed to predetermine any outcome. For instance, you could find that 60% of Californians favor lower taxes and 60% of Californians want greater services and more things given to them.
Yep.
That being said, do politicians, when they come to you and say, do a poll, do they ask you to show me a poll that shows vast support for something I want to do? Or do they say, I don't know how people feel on this. I want you to conduct an honest poll and tell me what the result is. And if that poll comes back and shows that they're opposed to what he wants to do, what happens to that poll?
Okay. Well, I mean, it's a reasonable question. Well, you didn't ask the question that everyone asks, that people get their ideas out of a poll, which is just not... I haven't worked for anybody who's come to me and said, you know, why don't you test the, you know, whatever ideas you think are interesting, and I'll adapt to those ideas. Almost everybody I work for, you know, has a life, you know, both a personal life and a political life, you know, getting there, and has fairly developed ideas. Now, there, you will often, you know, have this kind of initial meeting in which you will lay out, you know, what are the different theories of the race. What are the different issues that may be central, and poll on those issues? You're not. I mean, no one's looking for. Why would you look for a poll? What's the point of a poll that, you know, creates an exaggerated level of support on an issue? The goal is to see whether the issues that you've been working through are ones that you can use in this election. You can't run on every issue that you're, you know, working on. So there are frequently prioritizing of issues, you know, reflecting the moment. But if polls are exaggerating support, they will, you know, they, you know, eventually you lose elections. You run campaigns that lose. I mean, there needs to be transparency. There needs to be balanced arguments. I mean, the toughest thing to do is to write a balanced argument. It's not, you can write something, you know, are you for this policy? That's not very interesting. What's interesting is you say, all right, here's an argument for higher taxes. Here's an argument for, you know, for cutting services. You run them up against each other, you know, and which thing stands up against the other, and have I fairly developed each argument against each other, and it's transparent. People see whether it's real, and so that's much more the exercise. No, though Bill Clinton tried to I watched Bill Clinton try to rewrite the questionnaires to make sure he won, so that these arguments. So there's some support for your position.
Yeah, it just seems that you turn on MSNBC, it's shaped one way, and then you turn on Fox News, it's shaped another way. It seems that polls are used along with other statistics to shape the argument, to buttress a side, and not necessarily a true and accurate reflection of people's viewpoints.
Yeah. Groups of, you know, purchase polls, try to do that. If in campaign polls, there's not much point in it. You're trying to do what's effective, you know, to win. There's not much point in running ineffective campaigns.
Well, we've come to that point. We have time for one more question.
Dan, Tom Epstein, I worked with you in those early Clinton days, and now that President Obama is taking on health care, as, of course, Bill Clinton did, I wonder if you have any advice for how he could get a better outcome.
Well, all I know is that when I spent 3 days with Ira Magaziner, him explaining the health care plan so that I could then poll on it in a way that accurately reflected the plan. So, as a start, any plan that requires a 3-day explanation probably is the wrong plan. So without asking me, they've done almost everything that seems appropriate given the learning, from 94. I mean, healthcare 93, 94. Healthcare was an immense opportunity. It's tragic that it didn't, happen. I considered writing this book on that rather than the economic plan, in order to just start off the book with a happy story of, my failed advice. there were lots of things that were different, including the coalitions that were for it, the process for forming it. You know, what the President Obama has done is to, bring, civil society together around the table. We never had that, and Republicans. In a process to iron this out, he's trying to raise the money for it and establish some principles for the goals of the plan, but he appears to be leaving it to that process and to the Congress, to develop the specifics. And he's moving fast. I mean, probably most important, elections, create a moment where there's momentum. The election kind of defined, what the election was about, but also what the government should prioritize. Healthcare was one of the issues in 92, but it did not get addressed, for a year, in reality for a year. And you had lost a lot of the momentum, by that point. Bringing healthcare into the first budget, when I hear people say, isn't he taking on too much? My view is seize the moment. And the moment is now, where he has a standing and the momentum from the, you know, from the election and from the crisis, and you know, create, you know, I think, the kind of, you know, framework they're talking about creating. Thank you.
On behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, I want to thank you for coming today, and I want to thank Mr. Stan Greenberg for his wonderful speech. And but this now concludes this session of the Commonwealth Club. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Good.